I returned to the small house from which the vampire had taken the child, and left it there in its crib. Not very long after that I told Armand I'd seen Lestat. Perhaps it was a month, I'm not certain. Time meant little to me then, as it means little to me now. But it meant a great deal to Armand. He was amazed that I hadn't mentioned this before. We were walking that night uptown, where the city gives way to the Audubon Park, and the levee is a deserted, grassy slope that descends to a muddy beach, heaped here and there with driftwood, going out to the lapping waves of the river. On the far bank were the very dim lights of industries and riverfront companies, pinpoints of green or red that flickered in the distance like stars.
And the moon showed the broad, strong current moving fast between the two shores. And even the summer heat was gone here, with the cool breeze coming off the water and gently lifting the moss that hung from the twisted oak where we sat.
I was picking at the grass and tasting it, though the taste was bitter and unnatural. The gesture seemed natural. I was feeling almost that I might never leave New Orleans. But then, what are such thoughts when you can live forever? Never leave New Orleans again? Again seemed a human word.
But didn't you feel any desire for revenge? Armand asked. He lay on the grass beside me, his weight on his elbow, his eyes fixed on me.
Why? I asked calmly. I was wishing, as I often wished, that he was not there, that I was alone. Alone with his powerful and cool river under the dim moon. He is met with his own perfect revenge. He's dying. Dying of rigidity, of fear. His mind cannot accept this time. Nothing as serene and graceful as that vampire death you once described to me in Paris. I think he is dying as clumsily and grotesquely as humans often die in this century. Of old age.
But you?
What did you feel? He insisted softly, and I was struck by the personal quality of that question, and how long it had been since either of us had spoken to the other in that way. I had a strong sense of him then, the separate being that he was, the calm and collected creature with the straight auburn hair and the large, sometimes melancholy eyes, eyes that seemed often to be seeing nothing but their own thoughts. Tonight they were lit with a dull fire that was unusual.
Nothing, I answered. Nothing one way or the other?
I answered no. I remembered palpably that sorrow. It was as if the sorrow hadn't left me suddenly, but had come near me all this time, hovering, saying, "Come." But I wouldn't tell this to Armand, wouldn't reveal this. And I had the strangest sensation of feeling his need for me to tell him this or something, a need strangely akin to the need for living blood.
But did he tell you anything? Anything that made you feel the old hatred? He murmured.
And it was at this point that I became keenly aware of how distressed he was.
What is it, Armand?
Why do you ask this? I said. But he lay back on the steep levee then, and for a long time he appeared to be looking at the stars. The stars brought back to me something far too specific, the ship that had carried Claudia and me to Europe, and those nights at sea when it seemed the stars came down to touch the waves.
I thought perhaps he would tell you something about Paris, Armand said.
What should he say about Paris? That he didn't want Claudia to die? I asked.
Claudia again. The name sounded strange. Claudia spreading out that game of solitaire on the table that shifted with the shifting of the sea. The lantern creaking on its hook, the black porthole full of stars. She had her head bent, her fingers poised above her ear as if about to loosen strands of hair. And I had the most disconcerting sensation that in my memory she would look up from that game of solitaire and the sockets of her eyes would be empty.
You could have told me anything you wanted about Paris, Armand, I said, long before now. It wouldn't have mattered.
Even that it was I who...
I turned to him as he lay there looking at the sky, and I saw the extraordinary pain in his face, in his eyes. It seemed his eyes were huge, too huge, and the white face that framed them too gaunt. "And it was you who killed her? Who forced her out into that yard and locked her there?" I asked. I smiled. "Don't tell me you have been feeling pain for it all these years. Not you." And then he closed his eyes and turned his face away, his hand resting on his chest as if I'd struck him an awful, sudden blow. "You can't convince me you care about this," I said to him coldly, and I looked out towards the water, and again that feeling came over me that I wished to be alone. In a little while I knew I would get up and go off by myself. That is, if he didn't leave me first, because I would have liked to remain there, actually. It was a quiet, secluded place. "You care about nothing," he was saying. And then he sat up slowly and turned to me so again I could see that dark fire in his eyes. "I thought you would at least care about that. I thought you would feel the old passion, the old anger, if you were to see him again. I thought something would quicken and come alive in you if you saw him, if you returned to this place." "That I would come back to life," I said softly. And I felt the cold, metallic hardness of my words as I spoke, the modulation, the control. It was as if I were cold all over, made of metal. And he were fragile suddenly, fragile as he had been actually for a long time. "Yes," he cried out, "yes, back to life." And then he seemed puzzled, positively confused, and a strange thing occurred. He bowed his head at that moment as if he were defeated. And something in the way his smooth white face reflected it only for an instant reminded me of someone else I'd seen defeated in just that way. And it was amazing to me that it took me such a long moment to see Claudia's face in that attitude. Claudia, as she stood by the bed in the room at the Hotel San Gabriel, pleading with me to transform Madeleine into one of us. That same helpless look. That defeat which seemed to be so heartfelt that everything beyond it was forgotten. And then he, like Claudia, seemed to rally, to pull on some reserve of strength. But he said softly to the air, "I am dying." And I, watching him, hearing him, the only creature under God who heard him, knowing completely that it was true, said nothing. A long sigh escaped his lips. His head was bowed. His right hand lay limp beside him in the grass. "Hatred. That is passion," he said. "Revenge. That is passion." "Not from me," I murmured softly. "Not now." And then his eyes fixed on me and his face seemed very calm. "I used to believe you would get over it, that when the pain of all of it left you, you would grow warm again and filled with love, and filled with that wild and insatiable curiosity with which you first came to me, that inveterate conscience and that hunger for knowledge that brought you all the way to Paris, to myself. I thought it was a part of you that couldn't die. And I thought that when the pain was gone, you would forgive me for what part I played in her death. She never loved you, you know. Not in the way that I loved you. And the way that you loved us both. I knew this. I understood it. And I believed I would gather you to me and hold you. And time would open to us, and we would be the teachers of one another. All the things that gave you happiness would give me happiness, and I would be the protector of your pain. My power would be your power, my strength the same. But you're dead inside to me. You're cold and beyond my reach. It is as if I'm not here beside you. And, not being here with you, I have the dreadful feeling that I don't exist at all. And you are as cold and distant from me as those strange, modern paintings of lines and hard forms that I cannot love or comprehend, as alien as those hard mechanical sculptures of this age which have no human form. I shudder when I'm near you. I look into your eyes and my reflection isn't there. "What you asked was impossible," I said quickly. "Don't you see? What I asked was impossible, too, from the start." He protested, the negation barely forming on his lips, his hand rising as if to thrust it away. "I wanted love and goodness in this which is living death," I said. "It was impossible from the beginning, because you cannot have love and goodness when you do what you know to be evil, what you know to be wrong. You can only have the desperate confusion and longing and the chasing of phantom goodness in its human form." I knew the real answer to my quest before I ever reached Paris. I knew it when I first took a human life to feed my craving. It was my death. And yet I would not accept it, could not accept it, because, like all creatures, I don't wish to die. And so I sought for other vampires, for God, for the devil, for 100 things under 100 names, and it was all the same, all evil, and all wrong, because no one could in any guise convince me of what I myself knew to be true, that I was damned in my own mind and soul. And when I came to Paris, I thought you were powerful and beautiful and without regret, and I wanted that desperately. But you were a destroyer, just as I was a destroyer, more ruthless and cunning even than I. You showed me the only thing that I could really hope to become, what depth of evil, what degree of coldness I would have to attain to end my pain. And I accepted that. And so that passion, that love you saw in me was extinguished, and you see now simply a mirror of yourself. A very long time passed before he spoke. He had risen to his feet, and he stood with his back to me looking down the river, head bowed as before, his hands at his sides. I was looking at the river also. I was thinking quietly, "There is nothing more I can say, nothing more I can do."
"Louis," he said now, lifting his head, his voice very thick and unlike itself.
"Yes, Armand," I said.
"Is there anything else you want of me? Anything else you require?"
"No," I said.
"What do you mean?"
He didn't answer this. He began to slowly walk away. I think at first I thought he only meant to walk a few paces, perhaps to wander by himself along the muddy beach below. And by the time I realized that he was leaving me, he was a mere speck down there against the occasional flickering in the water under the moon. I never saw him again. Of course, it was several nights later before I realized he was gone. His coffin remained, but he did not return to it. And it was several months before I had that coffin taken to the St. Louis Cemetery and put into the crypt beside my own. The grave, long neglected because my family was gone, received the only thing he'd left behind. But then I began to be uncomfortable with that. I thought of it on waking and again at dawn, right before I closed my eyes, and I went downtown one night and took the coffin out, and broke it into pieces, and left it in the narrow aisle of the cemetery in the tall grass. That vampire who was Lestat's latest child accosted me one evening not long after. He begged me to tell him all I knew of the world, to become his companion and his teacher. I remember telling him that what I chiefly knew was that I'd destroy him if I ever saw him again. "You see, someone must die every night that I walk until I've the courage to end it," I told him. "And you're an admirable choice for that victim, a killer as evil as myself." And I left New Orleans the next night, because the sorrow wasn't leaving me, and I didn't want to think of that old house where Lestat was dying, or that sharp, modern vampire who'd fled me, or of Armand. I wanted to be where there was nothing familiar to me, and nothing mattered. And that's the end of it. There's nothing else.
The boy sat mute, staring at the vampire. And the vampire sat collected, his hands folded on the table, his narrow red-rimmed eyes fixed on the turning tapes. His face was so gaunt now that the veins of his temples showed as if carved out of stone. And he sat so still that only his green eyes evinced life, and that life was a dull fascination with the turning of the tapes. Then the boy drew back and ran the fingers of his right hand loosely through his hair. "No," he said with a short intake of breath. Then he said it again louder. "No." The vampire didn't appear to hear him. His eyes moved away from the tapes towards the window, towards the dark grey sky. "It didn't have to end like that," said the boy, leaning forward. The vampire, who continued to look at the sky, uttered a short, dry laugh. "All the things you felt in Paris," said the boy, his voice increasing in volume. "The love of Claudia. The feeling, even the feeling for Lestat. It didn't have to end. Not in this, not in despair. Because that's what it is, isn't it? Despair." "Stop," said the vampire abruptly, lifting his right hand. His eyes shifted almost mechanically to the boy's face. "I tell you, and I have told you, that it could not have ended any other way." "I don't accept it," said the boy, and he folded his arms across his chest, shaking his head emphatically. "I can't!" And the emotion seemed to build in him, so that without meaning to, he scraped his chair back on the bare boards and rose to pace the floor. But then, when he turned and looked at the vampire's face again, the words he was about to speak died in his throat. The vampire was merely staring at him, and his face had that long-drawn expression of both outrage and bitter amusement. "Don't you see how you made it sound? It was an adventure like I'll never know in my whole life. You talk about passion. You talk about longing. You talk about things that millions of us won't ever taste or come to understand, and then you tell me it ends like that. I tell you," and he stood over the vampire now, his hands outstretched before him, "if you were to give me that power, the power to see and feel and live forever—" The vampire's eyes slowly began to widen, his lips parting. "What?" he demanded softly. "What?" "Give it to me," said the boy, his right hand tightening in a fist, the fist pounding his chest. "Make me a vampire now," he said as the vampire stared aghast. What happened then was swift and confused, but it ended abruptly with the vampire on his feet holding the boy by the shoulders, the boy's moist face contorted with fear, the vampire glaring at him in rage. "This is what you want," he whispered, his pale lips manifesting only the barest trace of movement. "This, after all I've told you, is what you ask for?" A small cry escaped the boy's lips, and he began to tremble all over, the sweat breaking out on his forehead and on the skin above his upper lip. His hand reached gingerly for the vampire's arm. "You don't know what human life is like," he said, on the edge of breaking into tears. "You've forgotten. You don't even understand the meaning of your own story, what it means to a human being like me." And then a choked sob interrupted his words, and his fingers clung to the vampire's arm. "God," the vampire uttered, and turning away from him almost pushed the boy off balance against the wall. He stood with his back to the boy, staring at the grey window. "I beg you, give it all one more chance. One more chance in me," said the boy. The vampire turned to him, his face as twisted with anger as before, and then gradually it began to become smooth. The lids came down slowly over his eyes, and his lips lengthened in a smile. He looked again at the boy. "I failed," he sighed, smiling still. "I have completely failed." "No," the boy protested. "Don't say any more," said the vampire emphatically. "I have but one chance left. Do you see the reels? They still turn. I have but one way to show you the meaning of what I've said." And then he reached out for the boy so fast that the boy found himself grasping for something, pushing against something that was not there, so his hand was outstretched still when the vampire had him pressed to his chest, the boy's neck bent beneath his lips.
"Do you see?" whispered the vampire,
and the long silky lips drew up over his teeth, and two long fangs came down into the boy's flesh. The boy stuttered, a low guttural sound coming out of his throat, his hand struggling to close on something, his eyes widening only to become dull and grey as the vampire drank. And the vampire meantime looked as tranquil as someone in sleep. His narrow chest heaved so subtly with his sigh that he seemed to be rising slowly from the floor and then settling again with that same somnambulistic grace. There was a whine coming from the boy, and when the vampire let him go, he held him out with both hands and looked at the damp, white face, the limp hands, the eyes half closed. The boy was moaning, his lower lip loose and trembling as if in nausea. He moaned again louder, and his head fell back and his eyes rolled up into his head. The vampire set him down gently in the chair. The boy was struggling to speak, and the tears which sprang now to his eyes seemed to come as much from that effort to speak as from anything else. His head fell forward, heavily, drunkenly, and his hand rested on the table. The vampire stood looking down at him, and his white skin became a soft, luminous pink. It was as if a pink light were shining on him, and his entire being seemed to give back that light. The flesh of his lips was dark, almost rose in colour, and the veins of his temples and his hands were mere traces on his skin, and his face was youthful and smooth.
"Will I die?" the boy whispered as he looked up slowly, his mouth wet and slack. "Will I die?" he groaned, his lip trembling.
"I don't know," the vampire said, and he smiled. The boy seemed on the verge of saying something more, but the hand that rested on the table slid forward on the boards, and his head lay down beside it as he lost consciousness. When next he opened his eyes, the boy saw the sun. It filled the dirty, undressed window and was hot on the side of his face and his hand. For a moment he lay there, his face against the table, and then with a great effort he straightened, took a long, deep breath, and, closing his eyes, pressed his hand to that place where the vampire had drawn blood. When his other hand accidentally touched a band of metal on the top of the tape recorder, he let out a sudden cry because the metal was hot. Then he rose, moving clumsily, almost falling until he rested both his hands on the white washbasin. Quickly he turned on the tap, splashed his face with cold water and wiped it with a soiled towel that hung there on a nail. He was breathing regularly now, and he stood still, looking into the mirror without any support. Then he looked at his watch. It was as if the watch shocked him, brought him more to life than the sun or the water, and he made a quick search of the room, of the hallway, and, finding nothing and no one, he settled again into the chair. Then, drawing a small white pad out of his pocket and a pen, he set these on the table and touched the button of the recorder. The tape spun fast backwards until he shut it off. When he heard the vampire's voice, he leaned forward, listening very carefully, then hit the button again for another place, and hearing that, still another. But then at last his face brightened, as the reels turned and the voice spoke in an even, modulated tone. "It was a very warm evening, and I could tell as soon as I saw him on St. Charles that he had some place to go." And quickly the boy noted. Lestat, off St. Charles Avenue. Old house crumbling. Shabby neighbourhood. Look for rusted railings. And then, stuffing the notebook quickly in his pocket, he gathered the tapes into his briefcase, along with a small recorder, and hurried down the long hallway and down the stairs to the street, where in front of the corner bar his car was parked. This is Simon Vance. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Interview with a Vampire, Book 1 of The Vampire Chronicles by Anne Rice. Executive Producer Kelly Gilday. Text copyright 1976 by Anne O'Brien Rice. Production copyright 2011, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.